Hello, and welcome to this episode of The Politics of Living. I'm your host, Vicki Mazzone. Today's show deals with taxes, comedy, and choosing your happiness. Contributor Inessa Anderson presents a phone conversation with the Queen of New York Comedy. On The She-Ra Solution, Kristen Thiel delves into the life of the first African-American woman appointed judge. ML Laurie further explores our unconscious choices and what makes us happy. But first, I sit down with my guest, Jax Wheatley, who provides critical information about the sweeping changes to tax laws in 2018 and how it affects many people. Jax is a certified public accountant and owner of Rainbow Tax and Accounting in Milwaukee, Oregon.
In the 2018 Tax Cut and Jobs Act, it's officially called, you might see it referred to as TCJA. It's the most sweeping changes we've seen since 1986. In my career as a CPA, I have been through four major tax changes, and they all have something very similar in common in that they are billed as being good for the working class, when in reality, the changes are mostly good for the 1% and for corporations. In the Tax Act this year, they've come up with some new tax brackets and some new tax rates. They're slightly lower tax rates, which tends to have people believe that their taxes are going down this year. The problem is that there are new rules regarding standard deductions and itemized deductions, wherein it actually means that even though the rate went down, many, many taxpayers are going to actually pay tax on more dollars than they've paid in the past. So what I'm finding is there's no real savings for any individuals, at least the ones that are in my tax practice. Most of them are losing deductions because we live in a state here in Oregon that is considered a high income tax and high property tax state. One of the disadvantages of us not having sales tax. So the four main changes of the new tax code are, number one, if you are an individual who uses a standard deduction, your standard deduction has doubled. The second major change is where we used to get $4,000 or more for a dependency exemption, including ourselves, our spouse, any children, parents we're supporting, all those things, where we used to get $4,000 or more apiece, we get zero. The third is that in the itemized deduction range, where folks are itemizing deductions, the state and local taxes are limited to $10,000 total, regardless of what your tax payments actually are during the year. That includes state and local taxes, include property taxes, income taxes. It does include sales tax in states that have sales tax. It can include, in Portland, it includes the arts tax. If the total of all those taxes that you paid in is over $10,000, the maximum you get to take off is $10,000. The other major change to the itemized deductions would be that the whole section of what they call other itemized deductions, which includes things like your attorney's fees, your financial manager fees, your union dues, and those kinds of deductions you used to be able to take, has totally been taken completely out of the tax code, as if it no longer even exists. And then the fourth change is they have slightly decreased the actual percentages of tax that you pay. I think that's a misleading change because of all the other changes. That effect is minimal. The other thing that makes that effect minimal is that when they talk about a 1% change of taxes, it's not 1% on every single dollar in a tax bracket. It's 1% less when you're at the top end of the tax bracket. But if you're at the bottom, you might not get that big a change. So I don't think it's a big change, yes, because we've not had new tax bracket number, new tax amount percentages in many, many years. But I don't think that's where you're going to see a lot of tax savings. So one of the biggest changes in the tax code that they made was that they limited the amount of what they call state and local taxes, which is our income tax and our property tax, to $10,000. There are many places in the Portland metro area where the property taxes alone on someone's house are going to be close to or over $10,000. So that means normally where they had a $20,000 deduction, they're getting a $10,000 deduction now. The other thing that was done in the Tax Act that is, it's a huge disadvantage to a lot of my union folks and people who may work as a sales rep, is there's a whole section of itemized deductions that people used to be able to take that have been completely repealed, which means that they've gone completely away. I have one particular couple, that repeal of that section means that they're actually going to pay taxes on $60,000 more of income in 2018 than they paid in 2017.
So this is for sales reps and union people? And what are the specifics of that?
There's a section in the, there was a section in the tax code that allowed people who were employees to take unreimbursed travel expenses, to take their union dues, and to take things like if they're working from a home office, that's taking up part of their electricity, part of their internet access, a lot of the expenses they have from working in their home office, even though they're getting a paycheck from somebody, they're actually spending some of their money to be able to do their job. Those expenses all used to fall under other itemized deductions. That section has gone to zero. Some of the other expenses in that section were investment advisory fees. So people who had a lot of money in investments and were paying an investment advisor to help them with their money, those fees have gone away. Flight attendants get to take, and other people who work for the Department of Transportation, so railroad workers, those kinds of things, they were the big losers in this because they had, there was a way that they were compensated for living away from home while they're traveling. And it was through the tax code. And now they don't get that tax deduction anymore. The big sell on this tax code was that, well, we're doubling itemized standard deductions, which means that where if you don't have enough money to do the itemized deductions on your tax return, you would take a standard deduction, which used to be $6,300. Now it's $12,000. But in the old tax code, what you got to do is you had a standard deduction of $6,300. You had another what they called dependency exemption, which was $4,300. So really you were taking about between $10,000 and $11,000 of your income was not taxed. They sold the big, oh, we're doubling your standard deduction on the tax bill. But what they neglected to say, and it's kind of in the fine print of the new law, is that dependency exemptions still exist in the tax code. However, the dollar amount went from $4,300 last year to zero.
If a couple has children, how does that work?
Most of my couples who have children and are what we call middle class, not overly rich and not in the lower income sections, are actually losing. One couple I have has two kids. So where they used to have between husband and wife and two kids, they were getting $16,000 as a deduction off their taxable income. They are now getting zero. Yes, zero. That is the number I said. And that particular part of the tax code is they set the dollar amount to zero. They left the exemptions in there. And if nothing happens in the tax code between now and the year 2025, it will be what they call permanently repealed, which means they'll be gone forever. That was one of the big things that I found hidden. A lot of people were not talking about it. It wasn't in the news. It wasn't on anything really out there until we got our first set of, as professionals, got our first look at, here's what's in the new tax code. And I was reading through it and I went, wait a minute. This adversely affects clients. They're young professional folks who have a couple of kids. They're building their lives. They've been the backbone of the economy forever in this country, have been working families. And oh, they're now losing big. And it takes a very large percentage tax decrease of rate to equal $16,000. So I found that almost all of my clients who have children, who own their own home, and both partners work, are going to actually be paying considerably more in taxes in 2018 than they did in 2017.
So just to go back to what you said earlier, not being able to take the dependent, they can't write off the children anymore, basically. They could only write off $10,000 of the property taxes.
There are a lot of folks that think there are some changes in the code that very much help small businesses. So that is one good thing in the code. There is a provision for certain types of businesses where 20% of their net income is not going to be taxed when it hits their personal tax return. That's very nice. That's one of the winning places of the new tax code. Now, what's interesting about that is there's certain professions that that does not affect. CPAs are one. We don't get the luxury of that 20% reduction, nor do lawyers, physicians, or attorneys, or other licensed professionals. It's a very strangely worded section, and it makes you kind of wonder who wanted that.
Yeah, that would be my next question. Who decided that and why?
You know, without being present, you know, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall in all of these negotiations, as in, I can remember learning in high school physics about how bills really happen and what really happens in Washington, D.C. when they're deciding these things, and the used to be called quite frequently pork belly legislation. It's like, okay, if you want my yes vote, you have to put this in the bill. And so we have now a new 600-page tax code that is a lot of, if you want my yes vote, this has to go in it. So I don't know, I can't tell you who decided that these set professions could not benefit from this special tax write-off, but my retail store, my clients who own retail stores or provide other kinds of businesses, they're going to have some advantages. People who own rental property, who have a profit on rental property, that will get the 20% deduction. What I thought was interesting, I've done some preliminary planning for a few of my clients, and it's surprising how small that 20% really ends up being, though. It's another one of those where, like they did with the standard deduction, it sounds really nice when you talk about it in a theory, but when I actually put the numbers to it and see how it affects my clients, it's not a huge savings. I just did a projection on one of my clients and that is eligible for this special business deduction. It reduced their taxable income by $1,300. 1% of $1,300 is $13. That's the difference that it made in their bottom line tax bill. So it's not a huge savings. And that's what people are not seeing, is that what was billed to the public when this was being all proposed is, look, our rates are lower, you've got higher standard deductions, all of the things that were hyped up about how wonderful this new tax code is. When you actually put numbers to it, most folks are going to be very surprised when it comes time to pay their taxes in early 2019. Some of them who have not taken a look at what was withheld out of their paycheck all year are going to find themselves writing checks to the IRS for the first time ever in their life, and they don't know it.
What is your advice to people about how they can navigate this new tax code and what they can actually do to not have it cost them so much?
That's a good question. One of the things that is happening and is available is if someone goes to the IRS.gov, that's the IRS's website, and they do have some calculators on their website that allow you to, you would take your pay stub, you take pretty much a copy of last year's return, and you type in some numbers based on what happened to your last year's taxes and what you've had withheld so far in your paycheck this year. And it will tell you whether you should be paying more taxes or less taxes or how much you're going to owe at the end of the year. It's a fairly accurate system. I've been quite impressed with it. I've had a couple of different clients who've done it ahead of time and then come in to talk to me about strategies to pay less. But it was surprising how close the IRS's calculations come to what's happening with my tax programs. So I was relieved to see that there is some good information out there actually at the IRS's website about the new code. The other ways that I'm advising clients is if you have any tax credits available to you. Tax credits are always more more valuable than tax deductions because they're a dollar for dollar reduction of your taxes due. So I tell people, look for things that actually will give you a tax credit, not a tax deduction.
Can you give an example of some of those?
People putting new energy efficient windows in their house is one specific one. In Oregon, we have something called the Oregon Cultural Trust. And some of the places, including KBOO, benefit from the Oregon Cultural Trust. And when you donate to the Oregon Cultural Trust, you get a credit on your Oregon tax of up to $500 per person, $1,000 for a married couple. And it's a great way to, I look at it, when you use tax credits to help reduce your tax liability, one of the things that I personally consider it is I'm telling the government, this is what I value. So in Oregon, we have the political tax credit. We also have the Oregon cultural tax credit. So when I'm giving to those organizations, it's as if I'm telling the state of Oregon, these are the things that I value and that where I want some of my tax money to go to. And that's how I look at it. There are ways to figure out how can I not have taxable income this year. Sometimes there's a way to say, oh, if I get paid, especially if you're talking about dealing with investment accounts or things like that, maybe I don't need to cash in those stocks this year. Maybe I'll wait until January of 2019. I don't see it getting considerably better in the near future. I do find, though, that most folks don't understand that there are what they call tax brackets. And if you get to a certain income level, you immediately start paying a higher tax rate than you'd been planning on. So if by saying, oh, if I get an extra $500 in charity in 2018, I end up paying $300 less in taxes, that makes sense to me. So it's good to take a look at your taxes late in the year with what you know so far and make some plans based on the information out there.
Getting back to what you said about When you said that there was a book that the new tax code, when it was released to the professionals such as yourself, and you were finding all these things sort of buried in there, what is your sense that other tax professionals are aware of these new changes? And do you think that everyone's up to speed on it? I know you're speaking for a lot of people, so I don't really know how to kind of ask that question. But
well, traditionally, folks in the profession will always take a tax, for lack of a better word, a refresher course every single year before the season starts. This is the first year in a long time, actually since 1986, when we've been having to take tax classes all year long. As you know, there have been new webinars, there have been, there are still some issues that were not real clear whether they're, you know, exactly how they're going to be implemented, which is very scary to me at this late date of the year. Is that I have some things that we're thinking are going to be okay ways to interpret some of the new code. None of it has been tested in the courts, which is distressing to no end because the courts could declare parts of it unconstitutional. They have not. So this year, normally I take an 8-hour class. This year I will take at least a 16-hour class, getting up to speed. Most of the classes I'm seeing coming out in November and December, which is when most of us take our classwork to make sure we know everything going into the season. Most years I only take an 8-hour class. This year I'll have a minimum of a 16-hour class, and I've already done a couple of other classes. I kind of mentioned it a little bit earlier. There's a lot of misinformation out there. I get questions every week from people who say, well, I heard so-and-so told me. Some things I now know that I can say for fact, no, you didn't lose your business expenses if you're a self-employed person. No, the business expenses that got lost are the folks that worked from home who had a W-2 or get a paycheck. But there are other things I hear still where I say, you know, I really don't know. I hadn't heard that one yet. Let me look it up. And I have to stop and I have to look it up. So people who use a paid professional can expect to pay higher service fees this year. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. We can't afford not to because so much of what we've done this year has been education, and we have to look a lot of things up that we used to just because the code had been the same for such a long time, we knew things. Now we have to look things up, and we have to take longer classes, which unfortunately are more expensive. I'm a little bit leery of Some of the people I'm a little bit leery of are some of the older folks who rely on, or low-income folks who rely on the free services. I'm not sure that the folks providing the free services are going to get the level of education they need. Hopefully, most of them will not have huge issues related to the new tax code, and maybe even some of them will actually pay less in taxes. I know myself, as a CPA, a certified public accountant, I have, for every one client I have who's going to pay less in taxes this year, I've got five that are going to pay more. And I don't think I'm unusual.
Will there be some consideration on the part of the government to give people a chance to pay it installments?
Yeah. Most people who, the IRS does accept payment plans. It's expensive to do a payment plan with the IRS. You can do it, however. The reason it's expensive is because they charge you not only interest, which any bank would charge you, but they also charge you a penalty for not paying your taxes by April 15th. So my suggestion to folks that may have to pay into the system or owe money, know that as soon as possible. Find it out now by either going to the IRS website, consulting with a professional if they think they're going to have a problem with their taxes this year. Because if you start now, you've got 5 months until April 15th to pay the taxes, as opposed to finding out on April 10th that you owe $1,500. To some people, that might not be possible. They can't just write a $1,500 check. The other issue that I want to really make clear is that there's this misconception that if I file an extension, it means I don't have to pay until the extension is up in October. And there's nothing further from the truth. It has never been that way. If you owe the money on April 15th, it's due on April 15th. When you file your tax return is irrelevant. So even if you want to file an extension, the IRS expects you to pay what you think you're going to owe for 2018 on or before April. It's probably the 17th of 2019. There's always these weird dates because of weekends.
Is there any other advice that you have for people?
I think my first piece of advice for folks would be that I think people need to be informed. I understand that not everybody wants to talk about taxes, but there are ways to find out. There is some good information out on the IRS's website. I would be skeptical on some things and not so skeptical on others. You'd be surprised how many of your friends might know somebody who's in the profession who could at least even guide you. So getting accurate information that's not incorrect is helpful. And the other thing is, I do think that people should be doing their taxes earlier in the season this year. Get your stuff together now. Have it all ready so that as soon as you can get your tax information to whoever's helping you prepare them, you do that. Because if you do end up owing money for 2018, the problem gets compounded because it means you're not having enough taken out and you would end up owing money in 2019 as well. So we want to be able to fix both problems with the least amount of pain in our month-to-month budget. So the sooner we know that, I mean, as a matter of fact, I have traditionally always said I will not do tax appointments before February 1st. This year we're starting January 15th because I believe it's important that folks know as early as possible in 2019 exactly what is going on with their tax bill so that they can make changes, not only planning for if they have to write a check on April 15th, but also planning for 2019 to make sure that they're not going to get stuck again.
That was Jax Wheatley with critical information on the new tax laws. Comedian Emma Willman grew up in rural Maine as a class clown and went on to open for Louis Anderson, and now has her own podcast on Sirius XM and a show on Netflix. Contributor Inessa Anderson interviews Emma by phone. Although the audio is a little rough at times, it's a great conversation and a glimpse into one woman's life and comedic process. The conversation starts with Emma describing her visits to Portland, Oregon.
My sister went to Lewis and Clark for a semester, and then she transferred. Her boyfriend at the time switched schools, and so she went to New York. But so I went to Portland then, didn't really get to explore. It was really overcast, so I didn't get the Portland feel at all. But then I went back for the All Jane Comedy Festival, and I got to walk around a bunch. And then I went back with Louis C.K. when he was in Portland, And we stayed there for like 3 days. And that's when I really fell in love with it, because I was staying right in the heart. And I did the Bridgetown Comedy Festival. But the time I really explored it was when I was there, when Louis C.K. did his stop there. And it's such a great place to do comedy, because it's like all the open-mindedness of San Francisco without the attitude, what I my experience.
We're cultivating that attitude. Don't you worry about it.
Well, that's what people keep that people when I say that to people that live in Portland, they go, too many people are coming.
But let's back up and you, Emma, let's talk about you. Looking over your projects, so many, there's so much going on in your life over the last several years. I'm reminded of comedians like John Belushi, who I just saw on the History of Comedy, one of those things, you know, that I think you did too.
Oh, the CNN History of Comedy?
Yeah, yeah. And
I did a live show for them. I did 2 live shows with them, but I still haven't seen it.
I like to say that he was somebody who lived life in fast forward, You, just looking at all the stuff that you're involved with, he was relentless, and you seem to be that way, too. He's called the king of comedy in New York. I mean, he was considered the king of New York when it came to comedy. And you are certainly right up there with, you know, being one of the top people to watch and all that kind of stuff. So that's got a little bit of pressure on you, all the different projects, your Sirius XM show. Does it feel like you are living life in fast-forward mode, you know, being queen of New York comedy and everywhere else?
I definitely have a hard time being in the present, so that's been something I've been working on. But the truth is, you know, if you're like lucky enough to try to really go for it and be a professional in entertainment, that's such a privilege. Like, people are giving you their attention, and you have to earn it with whatever the quality of the product is that you're presenting. So that's a competitive. You can never take for granted how competitive that is, and it's. I think of it as like an impossible task. Like, I feel like you're trying to literally start a fire with your just from you walking or running or whatever it is, from the friction between you and the ground, you're trying to start a fire. And then, you know, as you move along, some, you know, you get people that start to help you along the way, but you're still trying to really do something that's totally nuts. And so many people say that they want to do it, but it is a lot of work. I like entertainment, and I mean sometimes it can get discouraging, especially with acting auditions. That's the thing I have, that's the where I'll be like the most. But I don't know how someone could not be relentless. Like, there's a few instances, a couple people that I've seen along the way that are so talented. I remember when I was in Boston, there's a couple guys where I'd be like, man, they're so funny. But then they never would really, over Boston when I would go back, they never moved up, never budged. And I think maybe that's what they want. Who knows? I'm not coming from a place of judgment, but I knew that that wasn't what I want. And then also you see, I would kind of assess it like, okay, what is this? What's the blueprint for what this person did? Whose life do I like? And then what's the blueprint for what this person did, and how do they do it? And I don't. Can't think of one where they weren't relentless in the pursuit. I just don't know how.
Yeah, well, it's really good to observe that kind of thing for your own self and say, okay, they're funny, but I don't want to get stuck in not making some kind of decisions about what I want to. I think it's very, very good.
So many people are funny.
Yeah.
So many people are funny.
Yeah.
Funny's got to be like the baseline, and then you got to figure out. Actually, you know what? Yeah. A lot of people are funny. I don't want to be like, so many. A good chunk. But, and humor is definitely subjective.
Yeah.
Too,
oh, sure. Of course it is. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is part of the trick of it.
Right. Well, you've opened for fantastic people, like you mentioned, Louis C.K., notwithstanding his, the right. deafening roar of the Me Too thing. That was a bummer.
There was a moment when my old tour manager said, Emma, you got to take it off your website. Take off the bio that you did that.
You're not going to take that off, are you?
I think I don't know if I did. I'm not sure if I did.
Well, but it was like so disappointing because he's one of my heroes. He's done so many great TV show, The Thing with His Family. I mean, you know, we could go on about Louis C.K. But you've opened for fantastic other Louis, like Louis Anderson. Like his character as the mother in Baskets is so crazy.
So
oh my God, that's so good. He's like, he's actually a mother that I would recognize in Louis Anderson.
Yeah.
What do you learn from those gigs, you know, when you're opening for guys like the two Louis, you know, in question?
So I'm glad you asked about Louis Anderson, because not a lot of people do. And Louis Anderson and I have an interesting backstory, and I learned totally different things from both of them. So I met, not totally different, but it was very different. I met Louis Anderson years ago at this Access TV taping that he was hosting. And I remember seeing him at the, I saw him at the run-through of it. And I'll never forget it, because he came in, he was sitting and watching the people on the show that night do the sound check. And then Craft Services went by with like a thing of pasta.
Uh-huh.
And once they closed the door, he said, where's she going with that pasta? And then just followed her out. And he's just such a character.
Oh, God. I just love him so much.
I don't know if he eats pasta anymore, but this was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But at that taping, afterwards he said, can I give you a note? And I was like, of course. And he said, you know, you said the word or you said, well, it had a swore in it. And he goes, you don't need that swear there. And I was like, okay, thanks. And then he said, if you have any questions about the business, or you get lonely while you're trying to do this, call me.
Ugh.
But he goes, any question, you can call me. He goes, but really think about that question. And wow. I didn't have any representation, or I didn't know the business well at the time. So then I called him. I thought of a question.
Oh.
And I think he checked in too. He goes, did you have a question? I said, what's the difference between a manager and an agent? And he said, you can come up with a better question. So you can Google that. So he said, call me when you come up with a better question.
Oh, wow.
And he was right. He said it very sweetly, though. It sounds less than it was. He was right, because of course, if you're not in the business, there's no reason you would know that, but it is something very easy to look up. So, and I asked him, I said, I have writer's block. What's, do you have any advice on that? And then he said, yes. And he said, write out a bunch of the first like 6 years of your life and don't edit it. And you can send it to me and I'll tell you what I think would be good for writing about. And I did it. And then he did.
Amazing man.
Isn't that crazy?
To take the time to do that? Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. He was like, I wouldn't talk about this. And then he said I would talk about the, you know, maybe some notes. This is years ago. And then this is before I was even doing colleges, because I used that access tape to get a college agent. That's when I started doing comedy professionally. But, yeah, so I've known him for like, and this was before Baskets. He's like, his comedy's so different from Louis C.K. Louis Anderson's very clean.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But I mean, to me, it's just as, you know, part of one of my heroes. I mean, he's just amazing.
What a guy.
Yeah.
He's
and so generous. So generous. Jeez.
So generous. And he connected me with this showrunner. And when her and I talked, she said, you know, Louis, when I first started doing comedy, gave me a little bit of like money to help the move. And she was like, she said, I could do it, but I can't pay whatever. It wasn't a big, she was like, I just can't pay this one fee or something. And he said, okay. And he helped her do that. And she said that he's, you know, just been a great source. And then a guy one time, he said that he was a valet. Louis connected me with him. He was doing a game show. And he was looking for writers, and he was a valet, and he met Louis at the valet.
Jeez.
And then he said Louis has been in touch with him. And I think Louis is a hustler, too. I mean, he's been in the business so long, I think that he sees it. I think he's someone who likes to give back, and he's very kind.
Yeah.
And then also it keeps, then he's very diversified, too. But
yeah, I think, I'm sure that he sees that as an opportunity to grow in his own way, you know, that he can offer suggestions and, I wanted to back up to your early beginning life in Maine. You know, you were talking about how Louis Anderson had suggested that you write down the first 6 years of your life, but I don't need you to go back
first
that early.
First 6 years.
But
right,
just,
where I said, I don't even remember anything. And
yeah.
Then I said, actually, I remember walking up a hill because my mom said she'd give me pesto for dinner if I did.
Oh.
And then he said, start there.
Yeah. But so, you know, Maine just seems like, okay, Stephen King is Maine. That's all I really know about it. I've never been there. But what was life like in Maine? I mean, in the sense that, you know, you grew up in a small town.
2,000 people.
Yeah. I mean, wow. Everybody knows everybody's business. When did you get a sense that you could be that edgy person? Maybe I'm saying edgy because that's how I see your comedy, who can elicit laughs and whatevers from people around you. Like, were you a class clown? I mean, when did you start feeling?
I was.
You know, oh, not surprised. We all need those. We all need those.
Well, being a class clown is an interesting thing for kids because I think a lot of it comes out when I think a lot of times, like the two class clowns were both. Were me and this kid, Tom, and we were both of our parents were going through, like, really intense divorces. Life in Maine was, like, I mean, rural. Like, it's so rural that when I start to describe it to people, they don't even know how to process it. Like, we don't even have a stop. We had one stoplight for a while, the blinking red light, and they took it down because it wasn't needed and built a roundabout. There's no stoplight in town because no one's going, you know, there's not enough people to stop and go.
Right, it's not a thing. Yeah.
So it's just it's a funny place where I feel like you really see the worst in everybody because you see how everybody is needed to make a town work. So it's like if you know someone, each person you see is like them plus their aunt and uncle and dad and whoever or like. In high school, when we'd have parties, everyone would have to go to the party. Otherwise, there's no party.
Yeah.
Same with prom. It's not the senior prom. It's the whole school has to go to prom. Otherwise, no one gets to prom.
Right.
So there was not like goth kid party, cool kid party. It was like one high school in the area was having a party or another high school was. Or we'd go for fun. Like we'd like, you know, you just like go sit and like drink on a field and so I always had a pretty active imagination, but the class clown stuff really started. I was like a real chubby kid. But then when my parents got divorced, I really became a chubby kid. I don't know if it was like me feeling uncomfortable with my body as I was like.
Trying to feed yourself. You're trying to feed yourself, you know, in some kind of manner.
Yeah.
You know, and like, mentally, physically, spiritually, you know, name it.
Right. And I don't know if it was like as I was like going through becoming like puberty and become more like a girl. I was like, what's going on? Because it's like this place feelings about being gay. I don't know what it was.
Yeah.
But as I got bigger, I started really being like louder too. So I was just taking up more and more space.
Well,
but,
yeah, that reminds me of John Belushi. You know, he was just so absorbed in.
Was he a big, loud kid?
Oh, yes. Yes. So that's kind of what started
you. Life in rural Maine was really. Not a lot going on.
Yeah.
But I loved it. But I never watched comedy growing up. And then when I was interested in entertainment, and then when I got to college, when I graduated college, that year out of college was the first time I saw live comedy and the first time it occurred to me to try that.
Where did you go to college?
Simmons College in Boston.
Oh, so you actually went to the big city. Yeah, you went to the big city. Good for you.
Yes, and if I had gone from Maine to New York, it would have not worked.
Well, who knows? You know, but you made a choice.
Maybe.
You made a little bit of a safer choice in that Boston is a little bit, you know, the way that it's, I find that New York, I'm sure you agree, it's just made up of really intimate, small neighborhoods. Every block you go has got
That's
something,
true.
You know, but anyway, I know that when I moved there to be a dancer, I was excited, but it was thrilling, but it was also very scary, you know?
So scary.
Yeah, totally. I totally get that. Well, let's talk about comedians and their role in our culture, generally speaking, and certainly currently speaking. You know, I mean, I think about women like Kathy Griffin, who really took it in the gut when she did that, that bit about the head. And I'm thinking, and I thought immediately to myself, that's her job. That's what she does. That's why
she's
there. Yeah,
I was very surprised by that. It was like the perfect storm.
There's so many, people out there that I follow, like Trevor Noah, Samantha Bee, going back historically to those who broke down barriers, you know, Lenny Bruce, Dick Gregory, George Carlin, Bill Hicks, Janine Garofalo. I mean, the list is endless, and their job is so important. You know, when I look back on George Carlin's old bits, they still sound like they were made for tomorrow.
Isn't that scary?
We need those people out there. You know, Bill Hicks is not all political, but he's culturally so viable. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And I just threw some of my heroes down at your feet, but who are your heroes that we should know about?
I like personalities. So Cedric the Entertainer, Brian Regan, old Cat Williams. Cat Williams is the most political of that bunch. That said, I think everyone does have a responsibility to themselves. I hadn't really talked about politics much, and for a long time I had been joking about how I didn't recycle and I'd lied to my moms about it. The other day I was like doing, like, that's not funny anymore. That report came out on CNN.
Yeah.
So it's this very small level of it, but I was like, okay, you have a responsibility to, like, not make light of that anymore.
Oh, you mean like the plastics and all that? Yeah.
Yeah, they were like, you've got 2 years left to be on planet Earth. It's going to blow up if everyone doesn't start recycling. So.
Yeah. It's interesting that you come around to seeing things in a different way, and that's evolving. What do you make of our current climate? I mean, what's catching some of your attention? Like, you know, the Susan Collins thing. Does it deserve your...
I was shocked by that. I was so surprised that she did that, because I think one thing that, like, Maine liked about her so much is that she was, like, reasonable, quote-unquote, you know, even-keeled. Like, she's not really pushing it in one way or the other. So I would have thought, at minimum, because of his temperament, during that case, she would want to prolong it. I was shocked that she did that. I mean, I guess it's like giving her the benefit of the doubt. If she really thinks she did the right thing, then I want to, like, hold her to a higher standard that she can't actually think that.
Yeah. So let's see what happens with your material as it comes out and on the Collins thing.
But, sure.
But how do you write? I mean, what does it mean for, do you have to sit down and actually, you know, kind of like Louis Anderson saying, write down your first 6 years. Do you have to write out your shows? I mean, what's the process? Or does it just come out?
For me, usually the way what it happens to is it depends what you're getting ready for. Like, I don't usually write it out, but I did Colbert for a second time. I recorded it. It hasn't aired yet. When I do that, it was like, okay, I had like 20 minutes of material that I was like enjoying, and then it was newer and I was having fun with. And then I sent the Colbert booker this one story, and she goes, that's not right for Colbert, but this one thing you said in there, build a set around that. So It's the trickiest thing for me is always figuring out, like, the opening. And then I like to always have, like, try to have an arc. So even with the 15, I want to make it like a story. So I wanted to do that with, like, 5 minutes.
You know, that's really interesting that you mentioned that that's the way they do it, because I, again, referencing back to like because we were binging on this comedy history thing, and there was that thing on Chris Farley, who did a thing with David Letterman. Chris Farley went there to do the David Letterman, and they cut him.
Was he doing stand-up?
He was doing, you know, because this was during the Animal House era and Saturday Night Live, and he was a crazy man, and there was something about the producers where they just, and David Letterman was able to apologize to Chris Farley's mother, because Chris Farley, of course, died, and it was just, he died knowing that he was never able to be on the Late Show with David Letterman, and David Letterman poignantly...
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, that he was able to apologize to Chris Farley's mom for not, you know,
for
cutting...
He maybe went off script, because you're supposed to have everything approved for
advertisers,
you have to get everything approved beforehand, in the moment.
Yeah, in the moment, because he was definitely that crazy kind of guy, very much like a Belushi, you know, and also drug-addled and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
And I understand why they would cut that, too. I mean, you're going on someone else's show. If it's your show, you do what you want. But until that time, it's like going over to someone else's house.
Yeah, absolutely. So finally, to wrap up, so what's next in the world of Emma Willman?
I got to get a scripted show. So that's what I got to do. Everything takes time. So I feel like anything that is someone's doing is the result of, especially like 6 months before. But that's kind of the result of it.
Yeah, cultivating all that kind of thing, you know, that's your job. That is your job. Well, I'm very happy that we have observers, keen observers of this life, like you, Emma Willman. It's been great having a conversation with you.
Next up on The Politics of Living, it's the She-Ra Solution. This is a monthly biography of women past and present, hosted by Kristen Thiel. Today, Kristen talks about a famous local judge here in Oregon. Mercedes Diaz blazed trails as the first African-American female judge in Oregon and was given support by others. In turn, she has passed that support and mentorship to the next generation.
People who become firsts in their field, for example, the first woman to do something, change not only the trajectories of their lives, but also make it much more possible for others to step forward and into similar roles. If you had any doubt that mentorship is more than just nice, it's crucial, consider the experience of Adrienne Nelson, the second African-American woman appointed to the Multnomah County Circuit Court. Nelson told Benchmarks magazine that the first person to tell her that she should be a judge was the first African-American woman appointed to that judgeship, and the first in Oregon overall, Mercedes Diaz. Diaz had, Nelson said, a, quote, profound effect on Nelson's life. Nelson went on to say, quote, what she did for me, she did for countless others, but it touched my life in a very special way. Mercedes Frances Diaz was born almost exactly 101 years ago, on December 13, 1917. Born and raised a New Yorker, all the way through her undergraduate degree at Hunter College, Diaz took her own early inspiration both from her mother, Mary Kuzma Lopez, and, impressively, from First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt. Roosevelt visited Diaz's high school during lunchroom director elections, for which Diaz was a candidate. The First Lady singled Diaz out, speaking directly to her about being diligent about doing what she needed to do to get ahead in life. Her mother had urged her along with similar advice. Diaz began considering law school during her first post-college jobs, when she realized people naturally opened up to her and that she seemed to have a knack for problem-solving. She moved to Portland in her early 30s and attended Lewis and Clark College's law school at night, while by day she worked, was a wife, and was a mother to three children. She was the only woman in her graduating class, in which she placed fourth. She next became the first African-American woman to pass the Oregon bar. After 10 years working in the law, Diaz was appointed by Governor Tom McCall to district court judge. Diaz's trailblazing accomplishments happened not just because she was on her own smart enough or because one person in charge was wise enough to appoint her. She also bested her competition even when the broader public was involved. In 1972, she campaigned to be elected as a circuit court judge. She had seven opponents, all male, and she won. This was the difficult, groundbreaking, challenging era of civil rights, women's rights, and she won, becoming the first African-American to be elected to such an office. And it wasn't a fluke. The public chose her again and again and again, in 1978, in 1984, and in 1990. Diaz's list of accomplishments, while she also worked as a full-time judge until mandatory retirement at age 75, is long and diverse. She directed the National Center for State Courts. She advised on the Oregon Supreme Court Task Force on racial/ethnic issues in the judicial system. And, oh yeah, she was director of the Pacific Ballet Theater. Diaz's husband for 56 years until her death in 2005. Was Carl Diaz. He was a Tuskegee Airman, helping break the color barrier in the Air Force during World War II. In an oral history project with Oregon State University a couple of years before he died, Carl spoke in part about Mercedes' career, including how important a community of trusted support was in order for her to successfully campaign. I assisted where he could, he said of his wife running for the position of judge. He continued, quote, there was always the necessity for having two or three strong people in the organization in order to run, and she's had good people with her and behind her on that. No one succeeds alone, in a bubble, untouched by others. As I said at the top of this segment, Diaz's regular positive check-ins with Adrian Nelson helped the younger woman to follow in Diaz's professional footsteps. Now Nelson, who is known as Judge, even outside the courtroom, as a term of, quote, endearment and respect, she told Portland Monthly, is giving the same kind of support to others. One of whom, who knows, may become another African-American woman appointed to an Oregon court. Nelson told Portland Monthly, quote, growing up, I had women who gave me parts of themselves so I could be a better person and have more opportunities than they had. That makes me very grateful, and it makes me understand that I need to do the same for others. I'm your host, Kristen Thiel, and I'll be back next month.
That was the She-Ra Solution with Kristen Thiel. ML Lori explores internal programming, our choices, and the state of happiness in the latest installment of Let's Stop for a Minute.
So let's stop for a minute. Let's think about this. In my last reflection, I left you with the idea that a stable sense of happiness can only be achieved from within ourselves. With this in mind, I went back to the question presented in the beginning and end of the reflection. Which of your software programs interfere the most with your happiness? Why would some people keep software programs that cause them to be unhappy? And how do we begin to become aware of our software programs? If it is true that a stable sense of happiness that doesn't go up and down can only be found from within us, where do we begin in order to achieve this happiness? It is very important that if this is a goal for you, that you begin to become aware of the software programs that interfere the most with your happiness. There are broad, learned software programs that we all as human beings seem to have, most of which are taught to us by our cultures. Then there are the learned software programs specific to each individual's life experiences. So think about this. A major software program that most of us learn from childhood is the myth that happiness is to be found outside of ourselves through others, objects, accomplishments, and other things. These things we need to be happy are often taught to us by our specific families and cultures, and sometimes vary as to what they are or the importance of different ones. In most cultures, these mythical software programs are reinforced almost continuously by the media and even by the people around us because they also have been taught the myths. This false myth that a lasting happiness can be found from things outside of ourselves is a myth perpetuated by all consumer cultures. After all, companies spend a lot of money trying to figure out how to get us to buy their products. Some even hire mental health professionals to help them figure this out. For example, there is an old ad saying Ultra Bright toothpaste gives your mouth sex appeal. So what is the message? The message is that we need to use Ultra Bright toothpaste so we can have sex appeal. Why do we need sex appeal? Well, to attract a mate. After all, we all know that we cannot be happy unless we have a mate or partner of some sort, right? Wrong. This is just another reinforcement that we can find happiness outside of ourselves. And in this example, the outside means of happiness is a mate or partner. This myth is perpetuated in many ways and in most cultures. If we begin with these type of software programs that most of us share, software programs that greatly influence our ability to have a stable sense of happiness, we can quickly feel more happy just by our awareness of these programs. This is true because once we become aware of this type of thinking, we are no longer at the mercy of these faulty software programs that we operate from without thinking. Awareness is always the key. We start to become aware by paying attention to what thoughts come up in our mind instead of just going about mindlessly, not paying attention to what thoughts come up that cause us to feel a certain way. This lack of awareness is what often is at the root of someone holding on to a software program that interferes with their happiness. We cannot change anything, especially a software program or a way of thinking, if we are not aware that it exists. So paying attention to the thoughts that come up in our mind is the key. The belief that a stable happiness can be found outside of ourselves, with people, objects, accomplishments, and other things, is a shared faulty program, a myth, taught to us by our culture. I call it a myth because it isn't true. One of the definitions of a myth is a widely held but false belief. We are not alone in thinking this way. Just knowing we aren't alone, that we share these types of programs with others, is very empowering. This is especially true in the case of the common, shared, highly faulty software program that most of us operate from, that says we are alone in our human experiences. So let's stop for a minute and think about all of this. So what are the software programs that we all share as human beings? Do you think that you are alone in many of your experiences in life, especially when it comes to interactions with others? Do you think that becoming aware of your programs can be empowering? Let's stop for a minute. Think about it. I'm ML Laurie.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of The Politics of Living. Thanks to our guests and our contributors, Jax Wheatley, Emma Willman, Inessa Anderson, Kristen Thiel, and ML Laurie. Also, thanks to our web manager, Denise Kovalchek. Visit kboo.fm and search for The Politics of Living, episode 21, to find links about today's topics and guests. All feedback, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to tpol@kboo.org. We're ending today with a song by Deborah Giannini entitled For Thoreau. Thanks for listening to The Politics of Living. I'm Vicki Mazzone.
It's time to tell our stories. There's good work to be done. It's time to reinvent the dream, the American dream. Heal the seas and prairies, there's a web to be spun, though it falls to us to carry the seed. Seeds, the wind will take them, they go to the wind like a song, and the wind takes you westward. Home. All the table talk of home, that's one place that we all share. But a modern life will keep you running on and on and on. When you've seen a bigger universe and you know what grows from caring, well, it falls to you. Carry the seed. Oh, the seed, the wind will take them. They fall to the sky like a song, and the wind takes you westward onto an old forest home. Now the legends tell of spirits that are deep in the trees, and it's true, as strange as that might seem. And even science now must say there's something healing there, though it falls to us to carry that seed. Oh, the seeds, the wind will take them. They take to the wind like a song, and the wind takes them westward onto an old forest home. If you're lucky to an old forest home, on and on, on and on, on and on.